And you're listening to Outbeat Collage, Out in the Arts, here at KRCB-FM, Rohnert Park, and KRCG-FM, Windsor, Sonoma County's NPR station, a service of Northern California Public Media, right here at KRCB 104.9.
Welcome to Outbeat Collage, Out in the Arts. I'm Gary Carnevale here in the KRCB studios with my co-host Mary Moore Campagna. Tonight we'll spend the hour chatting with the talented and beautiful John Beelan.
I like the beautiful part. That's good.
A singer, songwriter, producer. What else?
Juggles. It does impressions.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Guitarist.
We'll save that for the TV side.
Yeah, right.
He may even honor us with a song or two. This week, he begins touring with the Ronstadt Review, a show that recognizes the enormous talent of Linda Ronstadt. But first, we'll talk about KRCB's spring fundraiser, which is happening now.
Do you want to do that before the news?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's start a little of that right now.
Okay.
Mary.
Gary.
How can people donate online?
Nothing could be easier. All you have to do is go to your computers and then type in krcb.org/join, J-O-I-N. And that will take you to a page that, and then once you get there, you have to click on radio. There's one that says TV and one that says radio. You want the one that says radio. And that will show you a whole raft of different levels of donation along with the associated thank you gifts. What I do want to emphasize before we talk about some of the thank you gifts, and that will probably be interspersed throughout the hour,
yep,
is that there is no amount that is too small. None. Because I used to work as the membership database person, and I know that there are people whose donations, while dollar small, represented a larger percentage of their income than some other people's did, and who of course made much more money. So every dollar counts, and please don't ever be concerned about whether it's enough. It is enough, trust us, because this is what keeps the lights on, and it keeps the great shows coming in, and it keeps the place warm so that volunteer hosts like Gary can come in and not freeze. So once again, that's Sonoma County's NPR station here at krcb.org/join.
Very good. All right, well, let's hear from Greg Moralia with Outbeat Radio News.
This is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for the week of March 19th, 2023. Just 2 years after Arkansas passed a ban on transgender youth accessing gender-affirming care, the state's governor signed a law making it easier for people to sue healthcare professionals for malpractice if they provide it. SB 199 allows anyone who received gender-affirming care as a minor to sue their doctor. They can file a lawsuit up to 15 years after they turn 18 years of age, longer than the normal 2-year statute of limitations on medical malpractice suits in that state. The bill includes puberty blockers, meaning that if they're given at the time when they can actually block puberty and the patient changes their mind in their 20s or early 30s, they can sue the doctor that prescribed the hormones. The bill doesn't even require patients to show that malpractice actually occurred in order to sue for malpractice, instead allowing people to sue if they experience any injury as a result of the gender transition procedure related to treatment or the after effects. And that injury can include, quote, without limitation, any physical, psychological, emotional, or physiological injury, end quote. The law will make it impossible for healthcare providers to get insurance if they provide gender-affirming care to minors. In 2021, Arkansas became the first state to ban gender-affirming care for minors after Republican legislators passed a ban over the then-governor's veto. That law has not been implemented as a federal judge issued an injunction as a lawsuit against the bill works its way through the court system. SB 199 will go into effect this summer unless a court steps in and blocks it. And in the state of Ohio, The Advocate magazine reported that hundreds of armed far-right extremists, including Sieg Heil chanting neo-Nazis, joined by right-wing Christian groups, converged on a park in Ohio where parents and children had gathered to enjoy a drag queen story last Saturday. The extremists clashed with rainbow umbrella-wielding supporters who had shown up to protect the event. At Wadsworth Memorial Park, just outside Akron, the rock and roll humanist drag queen story hour ended in chaos as tensions raged between activists and protesters. A number of far-right extremists and religious groups, including the Proud Boys, Patriot Front 3, White Lives Matter of Ohio, Blood Tribe, that's a neo-Nazi movement led by a former United States Marine, and unaffiliated conservatives attended the event with the intent of disrupting it. Documentarian Ford Fisher captured the ensuing clashes on several videos that he posted on Twitter. For crowd control, local police had set up metal barriers before the event, but they allowed far-right extremists to carry out their organized terror campaign, which included screaming racial and sexual slurs, hurling vitriol at families simply trying to have a good time. Protesters carried weapons and performed Nazi salutes. And at one point, a masked extremist pointed at a black supporter and yelled a variety of offensive racial and homophobic slurs. One protester even pulled out a gun and pointed it at a group of supporters at one point in the video and tried to shoot it twice, but the gun failed. The unidentified man was later arrested in another incident after he appeared to strike someone with a pole. According to the Akron Beacon Journal, police are investigating the gun incident. And here in San Francisco, the Board of Supervisors last Tuesday approved an ordinance that would repeal part of the city's administrative code relating to its contracting ban with companies headquartered in states that have adopted anti-LGBTQ+ laws. The vote was 7-4 to repeal the ordinance that mirrors in part a state law that bans taxpayer-funded travel to states with anti-LGBTQ+ laws. The contracting element of San Francisco's ordinance is just one part of the administrative code. It bans city-funded travel to states that have adopted anti-LGBTQ+ laws and has been amended over the years to include states with restrictions on abortion and voting rights laws. The list of prohibited states now numbers 30. The reason for ending the contracting ban is because it prevents companies in those banned states from bidding on construction projects that could result in a better deal for the city. Some supervisors oppose the repeal because they don't know how the repeal would affect local subcontractors. California's travel ban was first enacted in 2016 after a national outcry over North Carolina's law preventing transgender people from using restrooms that aligned with their gender identity. The purpose of the statewide ban on state-funded travel to these states was a way to boycott and fight back against discriminatory policies passed in states like North Carolina. For Outbeat Radio News, I'm Greg Moralia.
Welcome back. I'm Gary Carnevale here with Mary Moore Campagna and our guest, John Beeland. Yes. Hi, John.
Hi, Gary. Hi, Mary.
John has a million stories. So for 5 minutes there, we were going over...
I'm the George Burns of country rock. Yeah, I've been around for a long time.
Great. And we're going to get to lots of those stories. But sure. But let's talk about the Ronstadt Review first.
Yeah, okay. Well, there's a lot of tribute acts out there, and I'm not really a big fan of tribute acts myself, but I worked with Linda. You know, I played guitar for her and back when she first started. So... when I heard there was a Ronstadt Review, I saw it on Facebook. I kind of went to YouTube and caught a couple live clips of them. I thought they were great. I sent him a little email. I said, "For anything I can do." And you know, the next thing I knew, I had a rapport going on with them, and they asked if I wanted to step out in the middle of their show and come out. They would introduce me as Linda's guitar player, and then I would come out, talk about Linda, and then do "Long, Long Time," her big record. And I said, okay, let's try it. So we tried it in Brenham, Texas, and it was a huge smash. So now I'm doing a number of concerts with them in Modesto and Livermore and Fresno.
Fresno.
Next week. And they are absolutely fantastic. And the girl who sings, Jasenia, your jaw will drop. I mean, I close my eyes. It's really difficult for me on stage to do long, long time with her because I played it back, 50 years ago with Linda. And so I'm on that stage, and I got my eyes kind of closed while I'm playing, and I hear, and she kind of looks like Linda, too. And she sings a long, long time, and I'm catapulted back to 1968 at the Troubadour, And it's an amazing experience, and they do all of Ronsett's catalog from the country rock songs to the Nelson Riddle tunes, the Mexican songs. So they cover the whole gamut, and they're absolutely fantastic. So, and it's fun for me to get back on the old stage again and shake up the cobwebs.
Nice, nice. And the trio songs with Dolly Parton, Emmylou Harris.
Yeah, that's right. I was Dolly's guitar player, too. So I don't know why it happened with Emmylou. I guess she didn't, enough is enough, she said.
Emmylou missed the boat, but, John. Yeah.
So that's what I'm doing. I'm working with the Ronsett Review. I'm also producing and playing on sessions for people around the globe.
How exciting. And you've just recently moved back to California.
Yes. I left Los Angeles and Hollywood in 1980 and moved to Nashville, Tennessee. And I spent 20 years there. I think that's my phone. I'm going to turn that off. I spent over 20 years there working with people like Garth Brooks and all of the stars there playing on sessions. But I always wanted to come back to California. I always felt that was my true home was in California. It gave me a career beyond what I could have ever imagined. And so finally, I just said, hell with that. I'm moving back. And everybody thought I was nuts because, they were saying, everybody's leaving California. What are you going back? But I'm glad to be back, and it's I feel like I'm back home,
Against the grain.
Yeah, definitely.
But you've got family here.
I have a daughter, and I have a son, daughter, and a granddaughter. And my brothers and my sister. Well, my sister passed away 2 years ago, but my folks are buried in Napa, and they have strong Napa roots. So, it's really fulfilling too to be after all this time to come.
Nice,
back. Yeah, it's neat.
That's great, really neat. And they're almost all musical.
I don't know where they got the gene from me, because before I came along in music, nobody in my family on either side played music, and so now I've got two granddaughters that record. I have two sons that record. So the apple fell close to the tree, I guess,
Nice.
And it's a really unbelievable feeling to watch them in action, too, because they're all real good. They don't just bang a guitar. I mean, they're up to, like, James Taylor good,
Wow.
That kind of stuff.
Do you ever perform with them?
Better than me good. Pardon me?
Do you ever perform with them?
Yes, we did. My son and I performed together, and which is really neat, and that's a really unbelievable story, by the way. A few years ago, I was on my way to Australia to work on an album, and I got this note in the email that said, you don't know me, but my name is Barbara, and I just wanted to write you because I think my son might be yours, too. And I went, oh, this is great. Just as I got the door into the cab, And so she says, here's a link. Hit the link, and there's my son in church singing. So my vanity, my Leo vanity, I hit the link, and the first thing that came up on the screen was this kid who was a ringer, 100% looked like my father.
Oh.
And I started shaking,
Yeah.
And
So
we took a DNA test when I got to Australia, and I told the band, the guys who were playing on the session, and they were all, all excited. And I took the DNA test, and it came back that... you are the father, So I called Chris. His name is Chris Beelan, I called him up, and it turns out, this is so freaky, but it turns out he has been following my career, not knowing that I was his father.
Wow.
And his playing, his singing, his demeanor, he's just like me. And so we're extremely close, and he's a wonderful, beautiful person. Donated a kidney to somebody he didn't even
know. Oh, my goodness.
I mean, he's just the most amazing person. It could have went the other way where he was on death row for murdering a farm family. I don't know. But Chris is a wonderful guy, and that's one of the biggest things that happened to me in my life was meeting him and his wonderful family. All of a sudden, now I got two new grandkids, and they sing, you know.
Shades of David Crosby and James Raymond.
Yeah, pretty much, you know. I always meant to send him an email to tell him about that and see what he thought about that, but it's the most incredible experience. I went to see his band play. After Australia, I flew back to Bend, Oregon, where he was. The whole town knew him. He's at George Bailey there. And the whole town was at the bookstore concert he was doing with his band. And I was standing up in the back, and the newspaper had done a story on it, you know. And I was in the back of the hall, and Chris told the crowd in the middle of his show, he said, "You've heard about my dad and everything." And well, he's out there. He's in the back there, and I'd like to bring him up and to sing for the first time with me, you know. So I got up there, and we did Paul Simon's The Boxer. And the place just went crazy. And I couldn't look at him because I'd bust out crying.
Yeah,
you know?
From
that moment on, we've been just connected at the heart, lock, stock, and barrel, you know.
Oh, what a story.
It's a great story. And I have a lot of music is a big thing in my family. And a powerful thing, actually.
Amazing. So let's go back to the beginning.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
Hometown, Illinois.
Southwest of Chicago. I was born there, and my family were one of the first families to move into hometown, which is now about 5,000, 6,000 people. And I grew up listening to, we were about 25 minutes away from Chess Records. So I grew up listening to a lot of blues and rock and roll. And I learned how to play guitar when I was about 11. I started taking a little trial course, and that's how it all started for me, playing dances and listening to records. I used to listen to records in a different way than anybody else would. I could actually envision listening to the records, the recording studio. I knew nothing about recording. But I would envision this kind of fantasy recording studio, and then the players coming in, and I kept thinking, that's what I want to do. I don't want to be a pop star have hit records. I want to be the guy who makes the records. So I wanted to be a session man. But I kept thinking, well, I'm never going to, you know, I'm in hometown in Illinois. Whatever happens in hometown. Well, what happens is when I turned 15 and 16, my dad just out of the blue announced that we were taking the train and moving to California, right by Los Angeles. So we took the train, 3-day ride, all my brothers and six of us, and my mom and dad, eight. And when we got to California, I ran away from home to Hollywood. And I was 17, and my mom and dad had the cops out looking for me, and they were hitting hard times. My dad's job fell through. We were stuck in California. My folks had no friends, and meanwhile they had all of the friends were back in hometown. My dad was too proud to turn around and go back home, which he wanted to, but he just couldn't, you know. And so that kind of fueled my hopping out the window and running away. It was just so tough for me to hear all of that in the house. And so one day I just hitchhiked on the Hollywood freeway. We were living in La Puente, California. And I hitchhiked and got a ride, and I snuck into Paramount Studios, and I watched them shoot movies, and I would go to the lobbies of the record labels, and I would see the stars coming in to record and make records, and I'd sit there and see Paul Revere and the Raiders walk by, and I was getting back home by 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd hitchhike all the way back home so my folks would think I was at school, you know. One day I get home, and my dad's waiting for me. And I said, "What's he doing home from work early, you know?" And so he says, "Jack, I want to talk to you, you know." And I went, "Uh-oh, you know." He goes, "How was school today?" And then there's a big silence, you know, and I'm going, "What does he want to know how school was today?" I said, it was fine, Dad. He says, "Well," he said, "I'm glad you think so, because his school just called up. You've been gone for 17 days. They don't know where you've been. Where the hell have you been?" I said, "I've been in Hollywood watching him shoot movies." "Well, you know, my mom screams, and I mean, it's a whole scene." So they said, "That's it. You're going into the Navy. You know, they've kicked you out of school. You can't go back to high school now. You're going to go to this continuation school, which is like a reform school. Real low life people there, you know. I mean, and so my dad dropped me off for the first day of continuation school, and he said, "Make the most of it. When you turn 18, I'll sign for you to go in the Navy." And so I was just beat, you know. I mean, I was at that age where just the world was crawling in. Mm. So he drops me off in front of the continuation school. I watched his car go down the street, and I just took the books and threw them in the trash, and I hitchhiked to Hollywood, and I never came back. And my ride took me to the Capitol Records building, and it was real early in the morning, like 5 in the morning. So I went to sleep by the dumpster in the back in the parking lot of Capitol Records, and I was awakened by this bus, you know, and I woke up and the sun was out, and there was this bus pulling into Capitol Records, and the side of the bus that said Buck Owens and the Buckaroos, you know. So I went, oh, I remember them. I used to see their albums at the hometown drugstore. So they're getting off the bus, and they must have had a photo shoot because they had all the rhinestone outfits. So I yelled out, hey, Buck, you know, how you doing? You know, and he turned around, he went, how you doing, kid? You know, and gave me a little wave, you know. Well, I ended up producing Buck Owens, and I ended up telling him that story, and he couldn't believe it. You know, I said, wow. He said, did that really happen? I said, I described it for him. He says, yep, that was it. And so a guy at Capitol Records gave me I went into the building, snuck into the offices, and the guy named Abe Hock, who was an A&R guy there, he listened to my little tape that I had. I had a little tape that I made in the bathroom on a Wollensack tape recorder. Just me singing on a mic in the bathroom with echo. And it was a terrible tape. As soon as you turn it on, you hear me singing, and you hear my brothers fighting in the back. Shut up. No, you shut up. No, you shut up. Everybody shut up, you know. And so Abe took this tape, and he put it on his big stereo system. So this is all blasting out of the speakers. Shut up. No, you shut up. And there's me singing on this bad guitar. So anyway, Abe says, listen, John, he says, you got a nice voice, but you need to develop it and see where you're going to go. So I recommend this club down the street. And it's on Santa Monica and Doheny. It's called the Troubadour. And
a little place
called
the Troubadour.
And he says they have open mic nights every Monday. You can go down there and play. And a lot of people have had their career started there, the association, the Birds, you know, everybody. So he gave me a little map, you know, and I went on Sunset Boulevard and hitchhiked and down to Santa Monica, and there it was. And I snuck in the back door and went up to the balcony and watched them. I watched them every night. Hoyt Axton and people like that on stage playing to a listening crowd. You know, I never heard of such a thing, you know. And eventually, after about 8 months, I was sleeping in the park, going to all of the anti-war rallies that were going on. And so eventually a couple came in and saw me playing on stage. After I got finished, the wife got me to the side. She said, my name's Lois, and my husband and I were in the Back Porch Majority. Right. They were part of the, and we have our own production company, and we're doing commercials and stuff, and we really think you know, if we can help you, let us know. Well, I was broke. I had no money. I had nothing, you know. And so the next morning when they came to work in Hollywood, I was right in the porch waiting for them. And they said, John, are you okay? Well, I busted out crying. I had no money. The world was caving in. And so they said, well, come on in. We went into their office. They called my mom and dad, who had the cops out looking for me still. And they told my mom and dad. My mom and dad came down to Hollywood, which was so foreign to them. Hollywood. You know, so they came down, and Lois and Dan said to my folks, they said, well, you know, John is, he's bitten by the music. I mean, we could tell that he's passionate about it. So you can take him home right now, but he's just going to run away and come back here again. So why don't you let Dan and I take him in? He can stay in our guest room, and we'll bring him to the studio every day, and he can kind of see how it's done, and maybe eventually play in a session. And so they took me in, raised me like I was their kid, and in about a year, I wrote my tunes were being recorded by Engelbert Humperdinck and people from the Lawrence Welk Show, and then I got a gig at playing on the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour, and then I met Linda Ronstadt, Spanky and Our Gang, and went on my first tour with Spanky and Our Gang and the Birds, And then from then I got to meet everybody, and I started doing sessions and playing on everybody's dates. So that's my life. Good night.
That's an amazing chunk of your life.
Yeah,
but
it is.
Hardly your life.
Yeah. Well, Dan and Lois were great. You know, they were real drill taskers.
Nice.
They wouldn't let me screw around in the studio if I made noises or if I tried to impress the other players.
Yeah,
they chastised me right over the speakers. I mean, it was a great training ground for me.
Yeah. So, and then you were signed by Apple Records.
I was signed by Apple in 1972, and I had written this song, and I was the music director for Johnny Tillotson, and he was doing a UK tour, and Johnny's best friend was now the head of A&R at Apple Records. So Johnny says to me one day, he says, "Hey, why don't you take that tape of that rough mix of that tune you're working on, and I'll set up a meeting with you with Tony King," his name was, and see what they think, you know. And I went, "You mean the guy at the Beatles label?" You know, he says, "Yeah, you know." I went, no way. And he says, "Yeah, I'll set it up," you know. So he set it. I set this meeting up. I took. We had a day off in London, so I took in Birmingham. I took the cab to Apple Records, and there it was. There was a building that the Beatles played on the roof. You know, there it is. So. Any minute I kept thinking, somebody's going to say, "Oh, it's not Beeland, it's Boland. We made a mistake by calling the app." Yeah. But I walked in the office and the hallway, and it's just nothing but gold up on the wall. Yeah, I mean, this is God. This is like
record.
Jesus and the apostles
right,
I'm getting
right.
ready to meet.
Musical
and
heaven.
I go to the elevator, and the elevator takes me up to the floor, and it opens up. And there's Tony's office, his huge desk, and more gold, more Beatles. And he says, "Hey, John," he says, "come on in, John," Tony says. And he says, "I've heard a lot about you, and, you know, what are you doing?" And I played him the tape, and he flipped out. He loved the tape. He said, "Listen," he says, "Ringo's coming in tonight. The rest of the boys are gone. They're in America right now," he says. "But let me play this for him, see what he thinks." I'm thinking, like, are you kidding me? All I wanted to do really was run out the door and go back to Birmingham, you know? And he said, "Yeah, you know." So I go, "Okay, you know." And he's just the sweetest man. He's still a friend of mine. And I went back to Birmingham and told Johnny what happened. And so I went to bed that night. And about about 9 in the morning, the phone rang, and it was Tony. And he said, "Ringo just loved what you're doing. How'd you like to join the Apple family?" And I couldn't put it together, like, what he was talking about, you know, at first. You know, I kept the Apple family. Was it Farmers or something like that? And then I went, "Oh, no, that's the Beatles. Oh, man," you know. He said, "Can you come down in a couple of days to, we'll get contracts and everything?" And yeah, sure. So I hang up the phone. I was screaming down the hall. I tell Johnny. Johnny's jumping up on the bed. He's excited because he set it up, and we go down. We went down to Apple and signed the deal. And my manager came out from. I had a manager. He came out from New York, and we signed the deal. And that night, the night we signed, we were doing a concert with Johnny Tillotson, Del Shannon, and Bobby V. And Johnny, when he introduced me to the crowd, he said, "My guitar player, John Beeland, just got signed by Apple Records today." And they all started doing and Del Shannon came out with a pitcher of beer.
Oh, wow.
And they drank a toast for me, and you know, and it was just unbelievable, you know.
And the album is available on Apple Music.
Here's what happened: the Apple ended up folding.
Right,
they had a big litigation going on with Alan Klein. So they were great about it. They said, "Well, you can keep your masters and make a deal elsewhere." Well, I got a deal like that because there was a label that was bidding to get me on Scepter Records out of New York. They had B.J. Thomas and a bunch of acts. So I was able to finish the album for Scepter, and it came out, and it's out there floating around.
It's out there. Look at it on Apple Music.
Yeah, you find
adorable it, John. How,
yeah,
so how old were you, John?
I was 23.
23. So cute, Mary.
And who knows? You may be combing your favorite used record stores, and someday a piece of vinyl with John's picture on it
really?
Will be there.
Do you have it on vinyl yourself?
Yeah, I have it on vinyl. Yeah,
of course you do.
I do.
That would have been the only way
absolutely,
it was available then.
Yeah.
But
well,
you still
know,
have
to be living in, you know, it was only like 8 years earlier, 7 years earlier, I was in a hometown listening to the Beatles on a transistor radio.
Wow.
And to be in London, and it was right at the end of the Carnaby Street, London, swinging London scene. So that was still going on.
Right.
you Piccadilly Circus and mini skirts and platform shoes and me and the Beatles. You know,
right.
I mean, how incredibly weird that was. So anyway,
that is an incredible story.
Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty neat. You know, I have to admit, I called my mom and dad up and told them that the Beatles had just signed me and. And oh, they were so happy. It was really something.
You mean after they got over the shock of thinking this can't be
after
real?
After they thought I was on the road to, you know, ruin.
Perdition.
Yeah, that's right. The high school dropout that ran away from home. And the guy actually did it, you know. And they were thrilled about that, you know. And I remember once calling them from Carnegie Hall. We had played Carnegie Hall with Arlo Guthrie. And I went to the payphone in the back and I called them up. This was in 1971. And I told him, I said, Mom, I'm calling you from Carnegie Hall. I've actually been playing Carnegie Hall. And my mom was crying. We all were, you know. And I thought, this is just like in the movies, you know. And I said, I love you too. And, you know, he hung up the phone and I went up the steps to the stage to get ready. And there was a curtain dividing the stage and from the audience. And I'm thinking, this is just like those movies where the curtain comes up and everybody's in tuxedos. And they're going like, well, the curtain came up and it was Arlo Guthrie's crowd. So it was tie-dye shirts,
right,
throwing frisbees and yelling out, rock and roll! Yeah. But it still was Carnegie Hall.
It's still,
know?
Carnegie,
yeah,
Hall.
That's right. And any way you dressed it, it was still. So, yeah, that was pretty neat.
That's great. Later we're going to do a lightning round about all the artists you've worked with, because John has all of these incredible stories.
He cannot hold a job.
He's written.
He does not need to.
Got all these names. They keep firing him. He keeps ends up.
That's great.
Well, just so you know, Gary, the reason that I mean, Apple Music is wonderful. Don't get me wrong, but you can't get the artist's autograph on it. Whereas if you've got a piece of vinyl or a CD or something.
Oh, of
that's
course,
exactly
of course.
Right. I hate CDs. I hated them when they came out.
CDs, I prefer to.
I used to love albums, reading them. And
oh yeah,
them and,
right.
You know,
you lived with that album.
Yeah, and it looked like a real deal.
The liner
you made a record.
And now you can get them again.
Art.
Vinyl's coming back.
Well, you know, I get chastised by my son, who's a producer, and when I say, what are you doing, Dad? I say, well, I'm working on this record right now. It says, Dad, don't call them records. Oh, excuse me, you know. And, I'll fire away. And I'll,
All right.
Yes.
We'll give you a little moment.
Okay.
We're going to let you turn off your phone.
Okay.
And we'll grab your guitar.
Yeah, sure.
And will you sing, perform something
yeah,
for us?
Yeah, I'd be happy to do a couple, or a song that I wrote. And if you let me do that, that'd be great.
Yeah, we'll give you a minute. We'll do our business.
Absolutely.
Maybe I can share with you guys what I always thought was rather an amusing story, further to what we were just talking about. I used to work with a woman who had married somebody in the Air Force, and they ended up going to Great Falls, Montana. And they were having a garage sale, and she had a whole bunch of records. And one day, they're kind of getting rid of everything, and her six-year-old son comes in and says, "Hey, Mom, how much do you want for these giant CDs?"
Oh, good.
That's funny.
Oh no! Oh no! We have incredible guests like John Beeland on KRCB, and we would appreciate your support. You can go to our website, krcb.org.
/join.
Joins. Click on radio. Look at all of the wonderful things we've got going. We've got T-shirts, $144 level DJ for a day,
yes,
which is incredibly fun.
It's going like gangbusters. What you get to do is you pay your $144, which can be split into 12 monthly installments, and you choose the show that you want to be on, because there are a few shows participating. And then you'll get to select the music, and you get to come into the studio and talk with the host, and then explain why you chose these songs and what they mean to you, and then, you know, get them played. And depending on the host, sometimes it's an hour, sometimes it's an hour and a quarter. Mm-hmm. Depends on how much fun they're having, I think. But it really is enjoyable. And if you're more of a literary bent, there's also something called Bring Your Own Book, which is similar, only it's the literary version. We have a literary show on first and fifth Sundays called A Novel Idea. And you can bring in a book that means a lot to you for whatever reason and talk with Suzanne Lang, the host, and explain why you really like this book and what it meant in your life, and even maybe read a couple of passages from it if you want. Same $144.
Wow, that's cool.
So, yeah, that's a brand new one.
Yeah.
DJ for a Day was so popular that we thought, well, we'll do this with the literary folk too. But that's one of our pledge gifts. And then, of course, there are many others, which you can see if you go to the website. And just bear in mind that anything that's over $48, including $48 and above, you can split into 12 monthly installments.
Well, I'll tell you one thing that I'll do. I just thought about it, but I have a book out that's done really great in the last 2 years, and it's called The Best Seat in the House, and it's all about my career and playing with Christofferson and Dolly and Linda, and I'll donate an autographed copy, you know, and so if somebody wants, you know, you can do it.
Excellent.
With it, and I'll give that to you tomorrow.
Okay.
And it's a neat book. It's gotten great reviews, and
you better give him two because I already know I'm going to sign up.
Okay. Well, great. Well, then that's a done deal.
Let's do that at a $60 level.
That sounds right.
Okay.
Mary and I are making up the rules as we go along.
Yeah.
Apparently.
Absolutely. No, that actually is pretty well. We had a gentleman named Ian Jones, who is a singer-songwriter out of Seattle.
Yeah.
And he was in studio the other. He's on a tour, and he was in studio talking to Brian Griffith. Oh. And he has a brand new album on vinyl. And he was saying that for a $50 donation, he would leave autographed copies. Well, Brian bought one, and our FM manager bought one. I mean, they made donations to, you know.
Nice.
So,
nice.
Yes, it's
yeah, well,
not
it's a neat book because it, you know,
it's an amazing book.
Talks about
John.
The Eagles, hanging out with the Eagles before they were the Eagles.
Yes.
And, you know, you name it, Elvis Presley, all the people that I've had a chance to work with over the years are all in there. Plus, the book's full of photos from my own personal collection of Ronstadt and Dolly and I on stage playing together. And so if you're a music lover, I think you really enjoy it. And the story's really good, too.
Amazing.
Well, John, here's the part you may not be aware of. Besides the fact that I'm not a wannabe guitarist. I know how to do it. I just don't do it well. And, of course, it's been a long time. But I also collect musician biographies. I mean, that's really what I like reading because so often I'll find stories that lend themselves to where I can quote them on my own show.
Yeah.
And so a musician biography by a musician that I've been talking to.
That's me.
I mean,
that's
I think me. I've died and gone to heaven.
It's heaven. All right, John, what are you going to play for us?
Well, this is a song I wrote. I put out like an acoustic album a couple of years ago that I recorded when I lived in Yountville, California. And this is just, it's called Bare Bones, which was a title cut from it. And writing has always been my number one special thing about what I do. I mean, I play good guitar and all that, but as a songwriter, I had my tunes recorded by a lot of people over the years, and it's paid for my kids being born. I've gotten so much for being a songwriter, and I've been able to co-write with some of the greatest songwriters in country music, and so, you know, my songwriting is a big deal. So, you know, although I get hired for guitar more than I do anything. But anyway, here it is. It's called Bare Bones. A lonesome cry from a hungry dog sends an old fox running to a hollow log. There's a kid in the kid in the schoolyard, a gun in his hand. Got the eyes of a child, the anger of a man. Bare bones, trying to get by, hand to mouth just to survive. Bare bones, struggling times. It's a chilly world when the sun won't shine. Neath the halo of an old street light, in the morning hours of a lonely night, she prays that soon her prince will come. Before she sees that morning sun, bare bones, trying to get by, hand to mouth just to survive. Bare bones, struggling times. It's a chilly world when the sun won't shine. On bended knees from an empty pew, the preacher cries, what shall I do? I'm losing souls here every day. Lord, I feel my faith just slipping away, bare bones, trying to get by, hand to mouth just to survive, bare bones struggling time. It's a chilly world when the sun won't shine, bare bones, trying to get by, hand to mouth just to survive, bare bones struggling time. It's a chilly world when the sun won't shine.
Oh.
Thank you very much. Stereo, nice. Stereo
beautiful,
applause.
Beautiful.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
So how many songs have you written? Could you possibly come up with a number?
I've written some, since 1968, probably I a couple hundred, maybe, you know.
I've
written some commercials, too, that have... were pretty neat. One was, they're terrible tunes, but the jingles made, you know, a lot of money, you know? And one was, let me see. When you're tired and you're hungry and you're dead on your feet, you don't want to cook, but you just want to eat, go to Jack in the Box. And we did for the Mazda cars when they first came out. There was one who went, well, I bought a new Mazda the other day. It's a great new car, I heard people say. Piston engine goes boing, 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 boing. But the Mazda goes. So, yeah, those commercials came in handy. They paid the rent quite a number of times.
But talk about some of the artists who you've written songs for.
I've written songs for, Ricky Nelson, the Bellamy Brothers, Engelbert Humperdinck. Let's see here. Kim Carnes. Bobby Bear, Ricky Nelson. I can't remember them all, quite a bit, you know.
Garth?
Oh, Garth Brooks, yeah. I didn't write for Garth. Oh, yeah, I did. I did write. I wrote a tune called We Don't Always See Eye to Eye, But We Still Walk Hand in Hand. And my co-writer was Dwayne Blackwell, who passed away last year. He was the most important inspiration to me as a songwriter and a guitarist. He started using me on guitar in his sessions in Hollywood back in when I was 18. You know, Dwayne wrote. He was a songwriter. He wrote. I'm Mr. Blue. When you say you're sorry, and him and his brother wrote that. His brother wrote. Little Red Riding Hood. And then Dwayne wrote, I'm gonna hire a wino to decorate our home. And then he won Songwriter of the Year for that song. And I did all of his demos. Everything that he wrote, I played on. And one important one that we did was back in 1986. He called me up. We were both living in Nashville. He says, I got a session tomorrow. I want you to play guitar on a new song. I went, oh, great, great. You know, and I went down there to the publishing office, and he played it for me. And it was Friends in Low Places. And I said, man, that's a great song. And, you know, that'd be a good tune for, I mentioned some country singer. And he said, no, I'm going to, on the demo, I want to get Garth. I've been using him for these, you know. And I thought, oh, Garth is okay, but I said, Dwayne, you know, you ought to use our friend Tommy because he's a much better singer. And Dwayne said, Garth is going to be huge, you know. And I went, Dwayne. I went, no, and this is what Dwayne reminded me of until the day he died. What I said to him, I said, Dwayne. I said, no country station is going to play a song by a guy named Garth. You know, yeah, and that's so I came up with a, you know, blame it all on my roots. Anyway, it was It turned out to be the biggest selling country music of all time.
Wow.
And we did a little demo in Hendersonville, Tennessee. And then Garth, I never dreamed in the world that Garth would be Garth. I thought he'd have a hit record
like
or something, but not
Elvis,
like,
almost.
Yeah.
Right, and
next thing I know,
Elvis,
next thing I know, he's swinging on a wire in the Radio City Music Hall, you know. And he did his debut on the Grand Ole Opry, and I was watching it on TV. And he killed the crowd. The crowd loved him, and he had three encores. It was, you know. So the next day, I wrote him a fax, and I sent him the fax saying, "Garth, I saw you on TV, buddy. You're going to do it. I'll be darned." I said, "We're rooting for you, boy, and congratulations." And you know, I'll never forget the old days. It was just the greatest, and we're pulling for you. Go get him. So 5 days later, I get this letter in the mail, and I open it up, and it says, "Dear Garth Brooks fan, although Mr. Brooks is busy, can't get to every fan letter, he's inviting you to join his fan club for $25. Now, I've played 25 sessions with Garth, you know, and now I sent the fax back to his manager, Bob Doyle, and Bob was just mortified. And he showed it to Garth, and about a couple days later, I got in the mail, I got this poster. And it was a poster of Garth, big one of him with his guitar and everything. And then he signed on it, "To John, here's to the old days when only you would play my songs." And I got it hanging in my studio. And, yeah, pretty wild.
That's great.
Yeah,
that's great.
Yeah, so, you know.
So talk about working with Rick Nelson.
Ricky was my favorite out of everybody I've ever worked for. I grew up in Chicago, in hometown, idolizing Ricky Nelson and Ozzy and Harriet Show and his guitar player, namely James Burton, who later became a friend of mine. And it was surreal because I was such a fan of his. I knew his music better than he did, you know. And when I got with him, I became band leader, and we started going back. Ricky was doing country rock stuff then, and. But when I got with it, we went back to doing the old hits and the old rockabilly stuff, which is what I like. And we did Saturday Night Live together. And Rick was a host that week. And it was the last year with the original cast, with Belushi and all of them.
Wow.
And we opened the show with Hello, Mary Lou, Traveling Man, Fools Rush In. And it was magic. He was the nicest man I've ever met in show business. And he did a lot for me, and I loved him like a brother. And it was very painful for me to leave him. Because I joined the Flying Burrito Brothers after Ricky, and the Burritos offered me a chance to produce and write for them, and I wanted to take that chance. I just didn't want to be a guitar player, you know. And so I brought it up to Rick, and he was real supportive. He said, "Go rock on," you know. And anyway, years passed by, and. And in 1985, he called me up and he asked me if I wanted to come back with him. The kid who replaced me decided he was going to go back home after this Christmas tour and get off the road. Would I like to come back and join Rick? So I said, "Oh, God, yeah." I was in Nashville. I hated Nashville. I wanted to go back to California, you know. This was my chance. So I told Rick, "I'm there." And Rick said, "Well, we're doing this tour in Texas and stuff." And I said, "Well, I'll be there right after the tour." And great. So we started packing up and looking at houses in Claremont and got all ready to move. And then the airplane crash came and killed them all. The kid who replaced me, Bobby, died. The road manager, Clark. And I knew it was terrible. And so I took it as an omen, and I decided to stay in Nashville. And I'm glad I did, because I got to work with Garth and a lot of other people.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
Ricky was the greatest. He was such a pro, you know.
Yeah.
And so much fun, because his whole show were nothing but hits.
Yeah.
So every song you played, the people went crazy, you know. I mean, they knew the first three notes. People were still, girls were still running on stage grabbing, grabbing him, and even the band, you know. And I liked that part. That was, at the time, that was pretty cool, you know. And except when a girl's coming at you at 35 miles an hour, and she wants to plant a kiss on you. But yeah, I did a lot of gigs with him, did a lot of TV shows, Dick Clark Show, etc.
Yeah.
He was the greatest.
And he was a huge star.
He's
been gone so long.
Everybody knew him.
Almost, you know, you almost forget.
Well, yeah. The other thing about him, at least from my perspective, is that not only did he have a lot of his own hits, but he did some magnificent covers. The first version of She Belongs to Me that I ever heard was Rick Nelson's.
I still remember the riff.
And personally, I liked it better than Bob Dylan's. Oh.
You know, I did. I arranged his last, kind of last record. I had this arrangement that I did of a Bobby Durin tune. And we did it on Saturday Night Live, and it was his last kind of big record. And but it had an acoustic feel like She Belongs to Me, and it had a little riff that went. It went. Every night I hope and pray a dream lover will come my way. A girl to hold in my arms. Know the magic of her charms because I want someone to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. You know, and we did that on Saturday Night Live, and we ended the show with that. You know,
he was great too.
Funny, great sense of humor. Yeah. Rick, and
that reminds me of when James Taylor was taking all the Sam Cooke songs and turning them into ballads.
Absolutely, and I love doing that. I love taking songs and arranging them.
It was great. Because what you just did was great.
You know what? Dream Lover was a rock and roll pop hit by Bobby Darin.
Oh yeah.
But when you transfer it to an acoustic version and an older singer is singing it, those teenage lyrics take on a whole different perspective, you know? And all of a sudden, you know, what seemed like a teeny bopper tune is like this kind of sad song
by a
lonely guy, you
know?
And,
right.
So anyway, Ricky was my favorite.
Oh, yeah. Nice. Now talk about Dolly.
Dolly is my second favorite. Dolly's been my dearest friend since 1977. Mm. I absolutely love her. I hear from her quite a bit. 2 years ago, I was in Nashville, and we did a session together. We did a remake of Coat of Many Colors. Mm. And she is the real deal. She's incredibly intelligent, incredibly talented, and she's got a heart. She's unbelievable. I had a cousin Brian, he passed away, who had Down syndrome, and he lived in hometown with my godmother, and my godmother died. Brian was real distraught, as you can imagine, and so his sister told me, and she called me up in Nashville and said, you know, could you get Dolly maybe to sign? Brian was a big country fan. I was a big hero to him. He had, you know, my picture up on the wall. I sent him a radio that had a little mark on it where he could get the Grand Ole Opry every weekend. So anyway, she said, if you could get Dolly to autograph a picture. I sent Dolly a fax. And about 2 weeks later, I heard from Janine, my cousin. She says, oh, my God, Jack. And I said, what? She said, a UPS truck showed up. And the guy brought boxes and boxes of jackets and hats and all this stuff to Brian, you know, and from Dolly Parton. And she said he just lit up like, you know, and which was a real sweet thing. I absolutely love her. I can't say enough about her. She's done so much for me, and she's such a sweetheart. And technically the greatest really singer I think I've ever worked with.
Yeah, yeah. You know?
She's just flawless.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. So, and such a unique voice.
She's neat. She's a great sense of humor. She has a very foul mouth sometimes, which makes it even sweeter. And I just love her. It's one of the few people I could say I actually love her because she's just the dearest person in the world. You
know? Wow.
Yeah.
So and still at it.
Yeah.
How long ago was it? Maybe about 17 years ago. She was here. She toured.
Yeah.
And they had her in one venue, and they sold so many tickets. They eventually did it at the Sonoma Fairgrounds.
I played up here in San Francisco where they're in 78. And And we did. I forget where we played, but we played San Jose, and it was right when she had. We did Here You Come Again.
And then she even had sort of a couple of disco songs. She had these dance songs.
Yeah, she did. And I mean, people loved her. You know, I mean, she's another one. As soon as she stepped out there, it was like perfect, flawless show.
Right, and a real show.
Oh, you know, yeah, she was great. Yeah. I mean, she's really funny on stage and personal. Yeah. And you can't say enough about her either.
Nice.
I've been real lucky to work with most of the acts, maybe one. I know you're dying to say who.
But not on the air.
That I really wasn't that thrilled about being playing for. And actually, that led me to the Dolly Parton gig. I worked with Mac Davis, and Mac was okay. I mean, he was a great artist, great songwriter. I just didn't particularly like playing that kind of a show. When we went to Vegas, he had this kind of schmaltzy with smoke bombs and a 1950s medley. And I always thought that he should have been like Christopherson, like really taking his songwriting to the real.
Good, beautiful voice.
Yeah. And they all made fun of Dolly. Dolly was our opening act. Mm. And nobody would talk to Dolly, but I did. And that's how I got to know her. On the tour, we played New England. I did a whole tour. And her and I got to be really great friends. And right when the tour was over with, she said, I know you're not happy with Mac. And I said, no, I'm not. You know, she said, well, why don't you, do you want to play guitar for me? And I said, yes. Right. And next day I turned in my notice, and Mac was a bit mad. But I was with Dolly, and it was fantastic, you know. So Mac was about the only one I really didn't, you know. So anyway, yeah, so Mac Davis.
We've got two books.
Yeah, two books, yeah. Best Seat in the House, and which I have copies of, which is that's the one that I'll give you guys. And
that's great.
And then I have one called Pass the Guitar and I'll Tell You a Story. And they're both on Amazon. And Best Seat in the House has done tremendously for me. I'm somewhere in Illinois. There's an English teacher whose grave is spinning. knowing that I wrote a book, you know. And
the stories are amazing.
I work real
John.
Hard on
I
it.
Mean
yeah.
that you
I,
know they really they fly off the page.
Yeah, they you know. You know, I amaze myself sometimes when I look back on it and think of how lucky I was to meet all these people and play for these people. And I don't know why. There's a million other musicians that play 10 times better than me. But I always got along with people real good. And I never kind of catered to the star thing, you know. And I think the acts that I played with appreciated that. And so I got along good with everybody. And I got to work with a lot of people at a time in their career when they were just starting to bust wide open,
right,
too.
Right.
That makes a difference.
An electric time.
Well, the other thing about it is when you tell these stories, you make those people come alive. I mean, neither of us have ever, you know, we may have heard of some of them, them, never met them.
Yeah.
And you're making them come alive for us.
Well, that's what the story should do, you know. For me, it's been an incredible, incredible journey. And when I wrote the book, it took me about 4 years to actually finish a book. Mm. But when I was writing them, all that stuff came to life with me, too, you know. And it was kind of a freaky thing, you know. I'd be writing about something in the 70s, and all of a sudden I'm back in the 70s, and I can, you know, reliving it again, you know. So
that amazing you can remember all those stories.
Yeah, I do, because they were such big acts, you know?
right
and it was at such an important time in their careers too.
Yeah,
I mean, it's just embedded in you, the
nice.
Christopherson stuff. I mean, it's just pretty amazing if you see this, if you read about it. It's a great story on him working with him, you know.
And it's an influential part in your life. I'm for the record, I'm 3 years younger than you are.
Sure.
And so a lot of those things that you're talking about were happening, you know, during my coming of age years, and that's rooted.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's all associated with experiences.
Well, you know, people appreciated music, I think, a lot more back then, you know. Songwriters, people really loved good songwriters.
Yeah.
You know? And the audiences were there to hear the songs and to, you know, it wasn't like audio wallpaper. It was, you know, the real deal.
Yeah.
You know? And it was really neat to walk on stage with Christopherson, and the first couple notes you play are like, you know, For the Good Times or Me and Bobby McGee, and people are just freaking, you know.
Oh, I can
and
imagine.
You can see, and in my dumb young life, I could tell by playing behind these people, just from the back, I could tell that there were some really history
magic
going on, and that people would be talking about this for ages, you know.
Right.
So you couldn't help but think that, you know.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just a gig where you played guitar and you got paid; it was being really a part of musical history.
Well,
you know?
You're magical, my friend, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
We're
going
to have you back, because that was the fastest hour ever.
Exactly. I mean,
we could
have easily filled
it.
Two.
Oh, thanks, Mary.
Of course, yeah. And community powered. radio right here with wonderful people like John Beeland. Go to krcb.org/join.
And by the way, if some of you have been listening and in your enthusiasm, you decided that you were interested in this book, I suspect that if you make a donation online, we can probably arrange to have it filled.
I'll have it personally signed.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, we thank you for tuning in. We thank John, of course. Thank you for supporting KRCB, Northern California Public Media. Please listen to Outbeat Radio every Sunday night at 8 p.m. Next week, Greg Moralia returns with Outbeat News in Depth. Mary and I will return April 16th when our guests will be Catherine Berenich and Nancy Kelly, the producers of The Unlikely Story of the Lesbians of First Friday, which will be screened at the Rialto Cinemas April 23rd. Have a wonderful week. Good night.
KRCB, Rohnert Park, FM, KRC, GFM Windsor.
Perfect timing.
From the concert halls to the juke joints, from churches to festivals in the fields, welcome to another episode of Bill Street Caravan, celebrating the sounds of Memphis for more than 20 years.
Heard around the globe on NPR Worldwide. Major funding for Bill Street Caravan is provided by the AutoZone Corporation and Memphis Tourism.
Hi, I'm your co-host, Pat Mitchell-Worley.
And I'm Jared Boyd.
This week on Bill Street Caravan, we have Luther Russell and Jody Stevens of Those Pretty Wrongs.
Grammy-nominated bluesman Guy Davis will be with us to deliver an installment of the Blues Hall of Fame, an exploration of the lives of the pioneers and innovators enshrined in the Blues Hall of Fame here in Memphis, Tennessee. Brought to you by the Blues Foundation.
That's all coming up right now on Bill Street Caravan.
Hey, Pat.
Hey, JB.
This week we've got Those Pretty Wrongs on the show.
Fans of Big Star and the Freewheelers will, of course, know the names of Jody Stevens and Luther Russell from their past output with those landmark bands.
But their work together, now across two LPs, is an altogether different experience from what fans might imagine.
The first thing longtime fans of both artists might recognize is Stevens' position in the band. The longtime drummer, known for keeping pace on number one record Radio City and Big Star's Third, is the lead vocalist in this new two-man ensemble.
Their self-titled debut was released in 2016 after the two recorded the record with much of the same gear that Big Star used, including Jody's drum set and, believe it or not, a couple of his former bandmate Chris Bell's guitars.
The collaboration came together in the end with two men situated miles apart.
That's right. They recorded the sessions for the first album on Jody's home turf at the legendary Arden Studios in Midtown Memphis. And then Luther completed the mixes in Los Angeles.
When it was time to distribute the record, Arden Records teamed up with California-based Burger Records to get the job done, completing the synergy of this Memphis-Cali connection.
The two took their spirit of collaboration a step further when they performed in Memphis with the help of the Memphis Symphony Orchestra to bring their arrangements to life.
Both their albums balance stripped down, tight production with an exuberance that begs for an even larger instrumentation. So adding an orchestra was a welcome addition to this sweet, understated, soft rock ensemble.
Along with all who were able to be in the room for the performance, we were fortunate to lay our ears on the result of this unique partnership.
Thankfully, though it might have been a one-off performance, our listeners get the opportunity to hear it too.
And it truly was a beautiful evening.
So, JB, you ready to jump into it?
Absolutely. Here's Those Pretty Wrongs, live on Bill Street Caravan.
Time to lose this senselessness of happiness with no address. A hurt that could be quick to heal. Let's put our faith in how we feel. A dream to dream in our own way. A heaven from our yesterday. And need it be a master plan? What more could there be, said Peter Pan. Waiting to live this moment, just been getting by. Waiting to live this moment, time to fly, fly, fly. Fly, fly, fly. We're untried but true in trust. The gods ring round the both of us, watching as the sky turns blue, and you are watching too. I know you are watching too, waiting to live this moment. Just been getting by, waiting to live this moment. Time to fly, fly, fly. Fly, fly, fly. And nothing is quite as real as how grounded we feel when nothing is promised for the future. Nothing is promised for the future. Happiness with no address, a hurt that could be quick to heal. Let's put our faith in how we feel. Let's put our faith in how we feel. Waiting to live this moment, just been getting by. Waiting to live this moment. Time to fly, fly, fly. Fly, fly, fly. As I lay me down to sleep, I convince myself to keep moving on, moving on. And when I've got my breath to take, there's a world out there and I can't make sense of it. Dream away, we are just a dream away. Jump on the carousel and dream away. Dream away, we are just a dream away. Jump on the carousel and dream away. As I glance behind, I see footprints in the path that I have made. But every day, the gold hopes and false steps, some will last and some will fade away, fade away. Dream away.
just a dream away. Jump on the carousel and dream away. Dream away. We are just a dream away. Jump on the carousel and dream away.
Here's more from Those Pretty Wrongs live on Bill Street Caravan. Yeah.
A hurricane of love, and it's silent tow that pulls us under and washes us ashore, and we fall in love once more. Deep water eyes and a face that makes a man unsteady. Destruction we grow out of this hurricane of love. It is not the wind that speaks to me, my love. It's uncertainty that rattles me, my love. Be my love. A hurricane of love, twisting, twirling times about us under the storm above. And this hurricane of love, a hurricane of love, and its silent tow that pulls us under and washes us ashore. We fall in love once more. It is not the wind that speaks to me, my love. It's uncertainty that rattles me, my love. Be my love. Thank you. 'Tis not the wind that speaks to me, my love. It's uncertainty that rattles me, my love. So be my
thank you. If you'd like to hear the clarinet solo, we'll have CDs and LPs for sale, and even cassettes after the show. Burgers are the record label.
Heartbreak or happy, I never got to choose. All set for lonely and ready to lose. Then there was you. Then there was you. Life below zero won't reveal what it takes, but we'd find the cracks and eventually break. Then there was you. Then there was you. Ran out of eyes to see what love could be. Thought I just got what I deserved. Then there was you. Then there was you. Heartbreak or happy, I never got to choose. All set for lonely and ready to lose.
Thank you.
That was Those Pretty Wrongs, live on Beale Street Caravan. For more info on the band, visit thosepretywrongs.com.
We'll be back with more music from Jody and Luther of Those Pretty Wrongs in a bit.
Up next, Grammy-nominated bluesman Guy Davis takes us through the life histories of the pioneers and innovators enshrined in the Blues Hall of Fame. This segment is brought to you by the Blues Foundation, and it's also available as a standalone podcast through iTunes.
White man's asking about you. Not my favorite set of words, Muddy replied. Which one? From Washington. Damn. Negro can't bootleg without a president of the United States coming for him. What do you want? Robert Johnson? Oh. You better sing for him, man. He gonna put you in the wall. Speck I will. Muddy caught a ride to the plantation commissary. He walked in barefoot and empty-handed. He saw a man he recognized as not the president. Yasser? Muddy said. Hey, you don't need to yasser me, the man said. I'm Alan Lomax, making records for the Library of Congress. Muddy wondered to himself, what the hell was that? Lomax was a young guy with dark hair, a khaki suit, and a record-making machine stuck in the trunk of his big Packard. I do want you to play something for me, Lomax said. Lomax had brought a Martin with him to the commissary. Muddy picked it up, took a knife out of his pocket, and ran it over the strings. Lomax popped off his own shoes and sat back.
Yeah, my baby.
Within the first verse, Lomax knew he had an artist in front of him. He made a test recording and played it back for Muddy. It was the first time Muddy heard his own voice on record. He thought, I am ready. Lomax thought he needed to get where they could make some records in private. He looked at Muddy's bare feet. How about a ride home? He asked. In the big Packard, Muddy directed Lomax to a brown shack floating in a sea of cotton. The cabin could have been there 100 years. Muddy swept a hand over the cotton fields. I've been pretty much brought up on this plantation. I started working out in the field when I was 10, 50 cents, maybe 75 cents a day. Muddy's 35 Ford sat beside the house. A little vegetable garden buffered the cotton from the back door. There was a hog pen on one side of the house and a chicken run on the other. The chickens cackled and the breeze rustled the cotton. I drive to Clarksdale 3 or 4 times a week and have a look around, Muddy said as he walked Lomax to the front door. Inside, Muddy introduced his wife, his uncle, his daughter, and his grandmother. She took me over after my mother died, he said. Lomax spied the wind-up phonograph machine. A pile of battered 78 stood beside it. May I? Asked Lomax. Help yourself, Muddy nodded. Flipping through, Lomax saw a couple of Big Boy Crudups, a Petey Wheatstraw, a Sonny Boy Williamson, Tampa Red. Who's your favorite? Lomax asked. Walter Davis on Bluebird, said Muddy. He sounded like Chicago. Muddy and Lomax went out to retrieve the record-making machine. They lifted it together, think weighed a ton, and carried it with tiny steps to the front porch. They set it heavily on a table. The machine had batteries, glass bulbs, and wire stuck in it, and a device that looked like a phonograph turntable. Lomax asked Muddy to open the window and passed a small microphone into the front room of Muddy's cabin. There, Muddy sat and played his own guitar.
Late over in the evening, child, I feel like blowing my home. I woke up this morning and find my little baby gone. Late over in the evening, man.
The phonograph needle dug a circle into a rotating shellac disc. Lomax asked, tell me when it was that you made that blues, Muddy thought. I made it about the 8th of October in 38, he said. I was changing a tire on my car. I had been mistreated by a girl. The song fell into my mind. Just like that, I started singing. Lomax asked, what other blues do you remember running on that same tune? My boy put the record out. Robert Johnson, he made Walking Blues. Lomax's heart began to race. Did you know Robert Johnson? I just see him at a distance when he was through here playing. Did you know that tune before you heard Johnson's record? I learned it from Son House. I've been knowing Son since 29. I followed after him and stayed watching him. Learned how to play with the bottleneck, studying him for about a year. How did you learn? Run home from work and practice 2 hours every day. Who was better, Robert or Son House? Huh, they about equal. Lomax left Muddy. A year of cotton field work, moonshine, and practice came and went. One evening, an envelope arrived at Muddy's shack. Out came a check for $20 and 2 copies of a record from the Library of Congress. Muddy cranked up his phonograph and played the song.
Well, I feel in my like I feel today. I'm gonna pack my suitcase and make my gear. When I'm troubled, I'm all
sharp goosebumps popped along Muddy's spine. With his grandmother's blessing and his record in his hand, Muddy soon called in sick and hopped a train, Chicago bound. Muddy went to his sister's place on the south side and learned the new life. The first lesson came right from his sister. She told him flat out, they don't listen to that old kind of blues you're doing now. Don't nobody listen to that, not in Chicago. Those big Muddy eyes looked a bit ashamed. His sister's husband tried to be a little more positive. You don't have to speak soft in Chicago. You're nobody's boy anymore. His sister's low opinion of Muddy's music didn't stop her from hiring him to play a rent party. From there, he got an offer to play at the neighborhood bar. Sitting down in the corner with his acoustic guitar, Muddy listened. The clatter of everyone standing, packed together, talking, laughing, shouting, clinking glasses, just ate up his sound. At one point, someone even put a song on the jukebox. They didn't even know he was there. Big Bill Brunsey cranked out of a speaker. That gave Marty something to think about. He heard about a jam session and went to a flat where all the names he knew from records were cutting up in person. Tampa Red, Big Bill, and Lonnie Johnson were sitting on folding chairs in the middle of the room, picking and making up verses. Muddy stood there smiling, his eyebrows raised. A slick-dressed black dude named Sammy Goldberg was there scouting for a record company. He and Muddy struck up conversation. Muddy felt like he was standing barefoot in the plantation commissary again. He said he could play Goldberg a song if he'd brought a guitar. When the jam died down, Goldberg asked Lonnie Johnson to lend Muddy his. Lonnie said, "No, man, I don't loan my guitar to nobody." Goldberg said, "Let the man play one piece on the guitar, Lonnie. What he gonna do? He can't eat it." Muddy sat in Lonnie's chair, leaned down to turn a knob on the amp, picked up a beer bottle, and slashed the glass neck along the strings.
"Well, baby, I can't never be satisfied, and I just can't keep on."
Muddy passed the guitar back to Lonnie by the neck. "I drowned that," Muddy said. "I put that in water and drowned it." Goldberg put his arm around Muddy and led him away. "That's a good mind to have. You should think that, but just don't show it." Goldberg got Muddy into the studio. Muddy recorded his songs, but realized being ready in Chicago required more than being ready in Mississippi. He needed more than his old plantation songs and a Sears Roebuck amp to drown out the constant noise of the city and that old hokum Tampa Red and Lonnie Johnson were putting down. Muddy knew those old guys didn't want any part of him. The words rolled through his mind. "You don't have to speak soft. You're nobody's boy."
Nobody. Oh, child. Why? That spell man is boy. But a man.
After moving to Chicago, Muddy didn't see Lomax again until 1968, almost 30 years after their first meeting. Martin Luther King had just been assassinated. His followers were completing King's final mission, a massive gathering of working poor people from around the nation in Washington. People rode mules from Muddy Waters' home plantation in Mississippi to join the movement. Others rode in wagons. They paraded into the nation's capital in a downpour and set up tents in the mud. They built a shanty town around the reflecting pool at the Washington Monument. Lomax arranged for some entertainment for the protesters, weary as they were from marching through the mud to the White House. He called Chicago and got Muddy to come play for the Poor People's Campaign. As showtime approached, Lomax hadn't seen Muddy yet. A stage had been constructed at the steps of the Lincoln Memorial. Lomax headed over there. Parked in the shade of the towering white temple, Lomax saw a gold Cadillac with feet hanging out its windows. Muddy Waters sat behind the wheel, his pompadour tied up, fast asleep. Little Walter leaned on Muddy's shoulder, snoring, his Florsheim shoes resting on the sill. Otis Spann was sprawled out across the back seat. Muddy's eyes opened slowly. He cocked a sleepy half-grin and said, "I'm ready." Half hour later, Muddy Waters stood on the spot where Dr. King delivered his I Have a Dream speech and gave his own Declaration of Power.
Thanks for listening to the Blues Hall of Fame podcast, brought to you by the Blues Foundation. The Blues Hall of Fame podcast is produced by Bill Street Caravan for the Blues Foundation, written by Preston Lauterbach and voiced by Guy Davis. For more information on the Blues Foundation, go to blues.org.
Looking for a fun way to make a podcast? This spring break, KRCB and the Sonoma County Library invite you to sign up for our Youth Podcast Workshop Series. Students in grades 5 through 12 will learn storytelling, interviewing, and basic audio recording and editing. And you can enter NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. Just sign up online or at your local library. Youth Podcast Workshops, March 20th through the 24th, from the Sonoma County Library and KRCB 104.9.
Hey, it's Doug Jane. Wednesday nights at 7, I co-host the New Release Hour with my friend Brian Griffith. We grab the week's freshest tunes, play full album cuts, and share witty banter. It's fun and informative, and I hope you'll tune in. The New Release Hour, Wednesday nights at 7 on KRCB 104.9 FM, Sonoma County's NPR station.
Bill Street Caravan has brought the sounds of Memphis to public radio airwaves for more than 20 years. And now you can see what we've been talking about. Check out our series of digital shorts through our website or go to ilistentomemphis.com.
I Listen to Memphis is about Memphis music today, the people who make it, and the places and culture that fuel it. ilistentomemphis.com.
AutoZone is proud to support Bill Street Caravan and many other arts organizations that strengthen the greater Memphis community. Parts are just part of what we do. AutoZone.com.
Bill Street Caravan is also supported by awards from Memphis Travel, Tennessee Arts Commission, Arts Memphis, and Tennessee Tourism. TennesseeVacation.com. The soundtrack of America was made in Tennessee.
We're back, and if you've just turned us on, we're in the midst of a spirited, serene evening with Those Pretty Wrongs.
The band consists of big stars Jody Stevens and Luther Russell, formerly of the Freewheelers.
Of course, both guys have been a part of various groups. In Jody's case, he was an integral part of the band Golden Smog.
And Luther started a band called the Boot Heels with Jacob Dylan as a teenager, prior to his work with the Freewheelers.
Since then, he's done a slew of solo recordings.
Luther and Jody, longtime friends, made the leap to bandmates after working together for 2012's Big Star Nothing Can Hurt Me documentary.
During a promotional run in support of the film, Jody asked Luther to join him in performing some live versions of Big Star songs.
The understated charisma in their chemistry developed there, but it was cemented on their first single, Lucky Guy, backed with Full of Myself, conceived during their early sessions together in Memphis.
Lucky Guy finds its way onto their debut record as a standout track. It's an optimistic anthem about being fortunate with what you've got and what you've been afforded in life. It's a fitting ode for a musician like Jody, getting another win out of a particularly storied musical career.
We consider ourselves fortunate to be along with him for the ride. Here's more from Those Pretty Wrongs live on Bill Street Caravan.
Torn and split, and the sun casts shadows over it, and the harvest moon is come and gone, and birds forget to sing their song. I'll be there with you, I'll be there with you. Time falls soft as a feather, and the daylight breaks, we'll put it back together. When hope is lost and nothing gained, you wonder why but can't explain. I'll be there with you, I'll be there with you. shadows over it, and the harvest moon is come and gone, and the birds forget to sing their song. I'll be there. Back again, amen.
blame or pointing fingers. It's not about shame or pettiness. It's about finding good intentions in a misdirected mess. It's about love and happiness. It's about love and happiness. About us and what we don't. Not about us and what we want. It's about how we feel between us. How to do what's best. It's about love and happiness. It's about love and happiness. Ah, la 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 la. Ah, la 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 la. Not about walls to separate or ways we can humiliate. It's not about views that isolate or hopes and fears that suffocate. It's not about blame or pointing fingers. It's not about shame or pettiness. It's how we can find easiness to forgive and get togetherness and make a pledge of love and happiness. It's about 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 love. It's about love. It's about love.
Such an incredible history and legacy from right here within these walls at Arden Studios. And do you ever sort of feel the kind of allure that this place has for miles and miles and miles, even across the pond?
Sure. And it's interesting because I walked through the front door and I walked right by pictures of John Fried, Fred Smith, and John King. You know, all three of them started Arden when they were like 14 years old. You were talking about reaching people around the world. It's, you know, Fred Smith and John Fry did just that. Of course, John did it with music, and Fred Smith did it with just a brilliant distribution kind of idea. Yeah, there are lots of stories and lots of great possibilities for people that come here to record. A lot of great, very successful artists and folks that just came in and were paying for studio time themselves and just wanted to come in for the vibe.
What is the advantage of making sure that you get into a space like Arden Studios? And also, it's sort of that thing that reverberates off these walls that may even be intangible.
In some regard, it is intangible, but it's vibe and it's gear and it's the facility itself. And we have some really cool gear here. But it's just knowing that pretty amazing things have happened here and still can. That kind of gives us an edge over home recording.
Well, we're here to talk about Those Pretty Wrongs, and you guys had this amazing show in the Crosstown Theater. How important was it for you to do this show with the Memphis Symphony Orchestra in your hometown and in Crosstown, which I know is a place that you've become quite familiar with?
Oh, it's incredibly important and so much fun and gratifying, and there's so much gratitude that we have for the Crosstown Arts folks and Todd Richardson and Jenny Davis and Jonathan Kirksey. who led the string players and who also wrote some arrangements for us. What an amazing space the Green Room is. Talking about vibe, the whole Crosstown Concourse, you walk in and it's this very supportive little community of businesses, but it's always important to play Memphis and to, you know, friends here in Memphis.
Within this live setting, was it a challenge at all to take the arrangements as they existed from these songs that you wrote with your friend Luther Russell and give them that sort of symphonic treatment?
Yeah, there's a lot of magic in strings, and that made it even more exciting for Luther and me to have the string players there with us and have Jenny Davis actually join us on flute on a song or two.
You know, are there any similarities for you as a player and songwriter between the Big Star repertoire and what you were able to do with Luther for Those Pretty Wrongs? Do you feel like there's a similarity between those two catalogs of music?
Sure, because I played with Big Star, and you know, that was over a few years, so that music's so much a part of me that it's certainly going to carry over into Those Pretty Wrongs and what Luther and I do together. Luther and I, too, had the same kind of influences with the Beatles and all that, and then Luther was a Big Star fan as well. So it all seemed really natural to just kind of carry on and put our own mark on it, but certainly, you know, Alex, Andy, and Chris were all big influences on what we do.
You know, when I see you around town, I'm sure a lot of people want to talk to you about Big Star, but I noticed that you always seem to truly make a point about this new music that you're doing, and this is two records in for Those Pretty Wrongs. I'm sure it might feel kind of old at some point, that people are so in love with the things that you did in the 1970s when you've got great work that you're doing now.
I love talking about Big Star if that's where the interest is, because then I also get to talk about Those Pretty Wrongs. And, you know, if it hadn't been for Big Star, I certainly wouldn't be sitting here at Ardent. A lot of great things have happened, and I wouldn't have the platform for Those Pretty Wrongs that we have. So that's cool.
Yeah, I know that these two projects have been able to come together through kind of a partnership between Ardent and Burger Records. How is that working, sort of a cross-promotion between a California label and a Memphis label?
Well, it worked like that for the first record, for our self-titled record, in that Burger pressed vinyl LPs for us, and then Ardent did all the digital formats and CDs. But the new record, Zed for Zulu, that came out this past September 6th, is just Burger Records. Because the Ardent record label is dormant at the moment, but maybe coming back soon.
And what's next for you and Luther?
Well, let's see. We open for the Jayhawks in June. It starts June 18 in Seattle, 19 in Portland, and 20 and 21 in San Francisco. And we're looking to add a few extra dates, just dates that would be on our own. I know we'll probably play a couple of in-stores, one in Portland and one in Seattle. Looking to go to Spain in November, and I don't know, there could be a date here in April that we're doing. We're just kind of figuring that out. So, I don't know, hopefully there'll be Australia, but they've had some problems with fires and been talking to a promoter there. Love to go back to England. We were offered a date in April there, but we couldn't work that out. The date itself would have been great. We just needed other dates around it and didn't have time to put those together before we had to make a decision. Maybe even we have a couple of seeds planted for new songs for the next record. So we'll just kind of keep moving forward. Hopefully add some more live dates and keep having fun with this.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Jody. Great to see you.
Thanks,
always.
Jared.
Here's more from Those Pretty Wrongs, live on Bill Street Caravan.
It's about being grateful for what you have. Woke up this morning, a little off track. Slipped out of bed and fell flat on my back. But I'm a lucky guy. Oh, lucky guy. Flew out of Memphis all the way to LA. Lost my voice, but I still found my way. Cause I'm a lucky guy. Yeah, I'm a lucky guy.
we fall down, we'll get up together. Cause in the end, nothing lasts forever. I see it half empty, I see it half full. Life can be a game of push and pull. Still I'm a lucky guy. Oh, I'm a lucky guy. There are people you know that'll find it hard to hold up, but with you I find it hard to give up. I'm a lucky guy. If we fall down, we'll get up together. Cause in the end, nothing lasts forever. Stars up in the
cold at night. You'll have the fireplace burning bright. Thoughts of how it's going to be and how I'll spend those cold, cold nights warm by you.
That was Jody Stevens and Luther Russell of Those Pretty Wrongs live on Beale Street Caravan. And the best way to keep up to date with these two and their collaboration is through their site, thosepettywrongs.com.
And whenever you see Jody around Memphis, he seems even more enthusiastic about this project than he is about all the great things he's accomplished before.
Most definitely. He is a man enjoying this very moment, and he appears inspired by the prospect of charting new paths and allowing his creativity to take new shapes. Special thanks to our supporters, AutoZone, Memphis Tourism, Arts Memphis, Tennessee Arts Commission, and Tennessee Tourism for their support in making Beale Street Caravan possible.
We like to remind our listeners to please show your support for public broadcasting. You won't find programming like this anywhere else.
You can find Beale Street Caravan on all the social media outlets. Do you love Memphis music? Tell us why and use the hashtag #IListenToMemphis.
Go to our website at BealeStreetCaravan.com. And sign up for our monthly newsletter to find out where the caravan is going to be next.
And you can always keep up with Beale Street Caravan via our podcast that's available through iTunes. We'll be back next week, so until then, I'm Pat Mitchell-Worley.
And I'm Jared Boyd.
And you've been listening to The Sounds of Memphis on Beale Street Caravan.
Be sure to tune in next time to Beale Street Caravan. We'll have the band Those Pretty Wrongs, featuring Jody Stevens of Big Star. Also joining us will be Grammy-nominated bluesman Guy Davis as he continues his series on the Blues Hall of Fame. That's all coming up next time on Beale Street Caravan.
Looking for a fun way to make a podcast? This spring break, KRCB and the Sonoma County Library invite you to sign up for our Youth Podcast Workshop Series. Students in grades 5 through 12 will learn storytelling, interviewing, and basic audio recording and editing. And you can enter NPR's Student Podcast Challenge. Just sign up online or at your local library. Youth Podcast Workshops, March 20th through the 24th, from the Sonoma County Library and KRCB 104.9.
We are Sonoma County's NPR station. KRCB-FM Rohnert Park, KRCG-FM Windsor, a service of Northern California Public Media. Learn more at krcb.org.